All right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 186. It's Tuesday night. This is when we like to talk to you about whatever issues you'd like to talk to in college football. Took a week off last week. I was out of town for a spring break with my kids, so took that off. It was the March Madness, so a lot of the shows I know I keep up with were talking about basketball, even though they're college football shows. But we're back. Let's talk about what's happened really in the past few weeks of college football, which, you know, even with March Madness going on, it's been a little quieter, but there's still stuff that's been going on. You know, a couple of really quick minor news and notes off the bat. Kind of sad news. I always don't like starting with these, but we might as well. You know, there's going to be one less D3 program next year. Birmingham Southern, which is a small private Christian college in Birmingham, Alabama, they have announced they're closing in May, so it's definitely going to end their football program. The Panthers have played since 1918. They're in the SAA, and this is unfortunately going to end their time there back in, I believe, December, according to AL.com. They said they were having some problems financially. They needed some help from the state legislature as kind of a Hail Mary. The legislature said no, so they've announced this week that they're going to be closing. It's a D3 program, not a huge one, but I thought I'd mention that. I always like to kind of note the passing of some of those programs. You know, kind of another quick, on a kind of a different note, we actually crowned some champions because, again, international college football exists. And again, small news and notes, but I always love these. British college football, the British University, I forgot what they stand for. It's Bucks. It's British University College Sports, I believe. And they have two divisions. They actually have roughly 100 college football teams there. They're very amateur, very club. Some of those guys who play over there are actually American guys who are doing graduate degrees. And some of them are actually some folks just from around the world who end up in England and pick up American football. They crown their national champions. They have two different divisions, and they play back-to-back on the championship game. So Exeter has won their lower division, the UK College Football Trophy Final, over Nottingham Trent. And the University of West England, UWE Bullets, have a three-peat after completely destroying Durham 52-0 in the top-level game. I don't know how they would do against others. I think Japan, Mexico, Canada, especially Canada, would wreak havoc over most of these teams. But I figured we'd just give that one a quick note. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can always hit request. My name is Bob Akayeri. It's Tuesday night. It's when we go over a little bit of things going on in college football. And again, we took a week off last week, so I'd love to just kind of go over some of those notes as well. This one, again, goes last week, but I just wanted to note that former Kent State safety Nick Saban has been inducted into the MAC Hall of Fame. It's so nice to see him getting that extra recognition. On kind of a wackier story I noticed this past week, this is coming out of Georgia. The Classic City Collective is offering Georgia fans an opportunity to plant a part of the new hedges at Sanford Stadium. That's cute. For $5,000. Okay, that one's a little bit more surprising. So there's apparently only 32 hedges available. Tickets will get you and five guests in and allow you to, I guess, you know, manual labor to plant a part of the new hedge and receive a commemorative gift as well as a reception in the locker room. So, you know, I'll give them credit. That's creative. That's certainly different. I wonder how many other teams can you know, have such significant things that you could plant on a regular basis. But that's one of the ways that one of the top programs in the country is trying to raise money. A couple of other interesting news and notes. Shehan Jayaraja, who is my co-host on a program I do for Advanced Media, he was reporting that apparently seven ACC schools have come to the ACC office to examine the strength of the grant of rights in the past months. In addition to Clemson and FSU, the teams of Miami, UNC, Virginia Tech, and NC State have also met with legal teams to examine the agreement. I would say that those aren't necessarily surprising names. Those are names we've heard of kind of in the background, where if Florida State and or Clemson break loose, they could potentially be some of the teams that are attractive. You know, one of the things I do want to mention is it seems like Clemson and especially Florida State are throwing a lot of legal money to help North Carolina, which is apparently viewed as the most desirable target of ACC programs to get free without forcing them to have to spend as much money on legal bills. Gosh knows, as an attorney, I can say billable hours wins out. You know, I see Ski Mask Smurfy, our regular friend, wants to come up here and join the conversation. Let's see here. Ski Mask Smurfy, how are you doing? Yeah, it's always a good time. I enjoyed it. It was so weird to be there and realize, you know, the March Madness. I'm not a huge basketball guy, but it was fun to see folks packing. Each day it was getting more and more busy. You'd see lots of fans in clusters walking around, you know, in their team gear, which kind of reminded me of which teams are in the tourney right now. But yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I mean, I don't want to get too much into sports gambling because the NBA has their hands full right now, so we'll get to that another day. But yeah, I did want to bring up, because I think either the last time we were on or the time before that I did mention, it sort of seems like the conferences are going to sort of like reinvent the power conferences, like the Power Five, because I said like Florida State and Clemson seem like the two who really wanted to leave the ACC, and it seems like they were targeting the SEC, but an 18-team conference just it just seems dumb, right? It's like it's too many teams. You're not going to really play anyone on the other side enough because you at least got to play inside your division for a season, or you just wouldn't have time to play any other schools outside of your conference, which at that point is sort of like there's no true measuring stick versus other schools, so it's just a little bundled together. It seems like they're trying to concentrate too much power in too few of a places, and it's just sort of like they need to just spread it back out again. Because I think the 12-team playoff is going to benefit everyone. But it just seems like these schools are headed the wrong way and chasing a little bit too much money.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, without really good central leadership, we have programs sort of reverting to looking out for themselves the most. And I do understand the motivation there. It's like, I mean, you could make almost a comparison to how nation states act in international relations. It's like, you know, look out for yourself. I mean, United Nations is cool and everything, but I mean, unless they can control you, you're going to do what you want to do, you know, and that's always been kind of a classic problem. I'm curious to see how the larger conferences operate. I mean, I remember back in the day, gosh, was it around 2010 when it looked like, and my dates are a little fuzzy here, but I remember when the Pac-10 nearly had a chance to become like the Pac-12 or Pac-16. If, you know, Texas and Oklahoma had decided to jump over and bring their friends and all of that stuff. And there, people were trying to figure out, well, do they go to the old pod model or something of that nature? And now, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how, especially the SEC and Big Ten make it work. And if the ACC breaks apart, and again, I don't know when that would happen. And if it does, I am assuming it'll be a few years. Who knows? Could be wrong. But I mean, you know, I'm assuming it'll be a little while there. We'll get a chance to see how they work. But, the money and the way it's being split up, particularly with that new CFP deal and, you know, just kind of looking at, you know, it's funny you mentioned the 12-team playoff. I mean, now we're, you know, 12-team for 2 years, and then we get that 14-team arrangement. It seems like it's hard to see how it's going to slow down. I think at this point, you know, here's where it gets interesting too, because I've had this conversation with people and I've had this discussion. Like when we're talking about the future of college football, when we're talking about, I mean, not even that far in the future, like the next 2 years, 5 years, what do I think is going to be the biggest distraction? I think right now the hot topic is, you know, realignment. Will there be more? Will the ACC break apart? How will the CFP work? Is it going to be 14 teams and how are they going to break it down? You know, 3-3, 2-2, 1, or however, whatever number combination you want to throw at them. I think those are really, it's fun to kind of hear them said out loud, but I think the real changer in all of this, and this, it's so funny too. I had an opportunity. I've had him. We've had him as a guest here on a Twitter space before, but I've also enjoyed just talking with him in general. Michael McCann, the professor of sports law at New Hampshire, I had a conversation with him with Jahanjay Raja of CBS on this other program we do. And you know, I think the inevitability, the biggest question, the biggest change of the sport is going to be the college athletes being named employees. And then we're going to really see a shift, because that's going to really force all of these programs to do a self-assessment that they've never probably, I mean, I'm sure in the background, I mean, at this point it's inevitable. I mean, unless Congress does something, and it's extremely unlikely. I mean, what was it? They had that round table a couple of weeks ago, and a parallel House hearing on the subject of, you know, can they stop, you know, players from either forming a union or being employees? And even the most optimistic person, who was Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who had called the roundtable meeting, he gave it a 50-50 chance. That is like the most optimistic number I've ever heard. It's not a 50-50 chance. There's like no chance of anything passing through Congress to bail the NCAA out, at least in this, heading into this election year. I mean, that's just, they're going to lose that momentum in a couple of months, and there's no chance, I think, of it ever going through. The reason I say that is, without Congress, then really either through, gosh, NLRB or through some legal decision somewhere, is absolutely inevitable that we're going to have players declared as employees in some way, shape, or form. And if that happens, we're going to see it's going to absolutely force all of these programs to seriously look at their numbers and their finances and decide, how far do they want to go? And I'm sure, you know, we're going to see some cases of teams that might be on that border trying to still make it work. But I don't know if they all can do it. But that factor in it is going to only feed into, sir, this is a really long-winded answer, but it's really going to feed into that whole question, that issue you brought up of, you know, the greed that's kind of driving all of this. Because if suddenly the greed has led, because I mean, you think about how this all turned out, you know, the NIL rules, loosening them up, you know, state by state, this states competing with each other, making the NIL rules so loose that even, excuse me, even a year ago, it seemed like they were going to be inevitably considered employees with how much ease they were giving it. But with the increase in, sorry, excuse me, I've got, go ahead, Ski Mask Murphy. I've got a little bit of a cold I'm nursing from Vegas, but go ahead.
Oh no, not getting a cold in the desert, literally, like the joke. That's a good situation. But I was gonna say, yeah, to comment on like you saying, like we're eventually heading the way where student athletes are gonna become employees. It sort of seems like, because of course I watch international soccer and a few other international sports from time to time, but mostly soccer. I always sort of pick up this, it's sort of weird that in the U.S., especially when I talk to people in college who are international students, had more exposure to them and them exposure to us. It sort of seems weird that with American sports, there's sort of like that weird barrier entry point of that, instead of, you know, just going to play pro immediately once you're actually that good. It's sort of like, hey, you need to go to college first. And I think that's sort of the weird thing that I think was always going to come to a head. Is almost every other professional sport outside of really American sports, you sort of like, hey, once you get to a certain age, you just go and play that once you're good enough. Sort of like, mm-hmm. The best examples I can think of is like, who are big names that people might recognize, like Neymar, the Brazilian soccer player, or Kylian Mbappe, the French soccer player. Like when they were 14 and 15, those guys were getting like $250,000 a year playing for youth academies and lower divisions of soccer. And it sort of seems like in America, we sort of don't have that build up to there. I mean, the NBA sort of tried it with G League Ignite, but I sort of see it with college football where it's going that way, where it's sort of like that buffer zone is getting real small between like, hey, once the money starts coming in, it's sort of like that gray area is sort of shrinking with all sports, but with college football, I don't know where it's really going to go.
Yeah. College football has always been, I think, the trickiest one, only because, you know, you're right. The NBA's tried the G League, although I believe they've said they're going to kind of re-examine parts of it, at least. One of the teams, I think, was comprising people who never played in college. And yeah. I think they hinted they were going to take a look at it, only because college is now, with the NIL rules, even without official employment, has become financially attractive enough that it may not necessarily be, I think the NBA sees it might not be necessary. I mean, hockey, I'll throw them in too, because historically, at least in Canada still, you know, the real key prospects go and enter basically, you know, their own amateur leagues rather than college leagues. Although I have to say over the last decade or so, there's been a noted increase in pro hockey prospects actually wanting to, instead of going to the amateur leagues, join NCAA hockey. And this is before like NIL. I just thought apparently the game was getting good enough and the experience was getting good enough that we were starting to see more of those, which is unexpected. I thought hockey was going to be locked in that way forever, especially with the leagues they have in Canada and such. But soccer is a great example. I do wonder, though, with soccer, it's not like there isn't physical development. I'm not going to BS that. I mean, certainly there's a lot of physical development in soccer, but with football, it's a little trickier. And I think there certainly have been attempts to create, I mean, you occasionally hear them. They never go anywhere. But I've read occasionally of like, oh, we're starting a new league. It's like a handful of teams in like Memphis or some southern team, southern town, pardon me, where they're trying to create an alternative to kind of put guys in a position to maybe develop their way up. I'm not entirely 100% certain because they never go anywhere. I think part of the problem is the amount of money it goes to create a football program at all. And that is something that I do think has influenced and allowed kind of college football to be this much. I mean, it's always been a minor league, but certainly kind of retain that.
Yeah, I was going to say that now it's the UFL, which not to be confused with the original UFL, which is now a combination of the XFL, USFL. It's not to be confused with the old USFL or XFL. It's, I don't know why they're repeating names, but I mean, those with the whole spring season thing, it seems like it may sort of work itself out with them combining and having some support from the NFL, which I think could be a path, because there was one player, if I remember his name correctly, who sort of got suspended from the University of West Virginia, and then because he couldn't play the season, he joined up for the XFL, and then being like a fifth or sixth round draft pick, which I thought after that, like, some guys may have seen as a more viable path, but then NIL came in and sort of ruined that. So I think the NFL is sort of relying on college to sort of be their system of developing talent before they get to the NFL. If they're not going to make the kids employees, the NFL may have to step in and, like, do something different, like just create a small other league. Because, I mean, I do remember someone tried it here in Virginia, and that didn't go well. But, yeah, we're getting to a weird, like, nexus point where it's like, we either got to go one way or the other. We can't be in the gray in the middle.
Yeah, I just want to mention one kind of oddball prospect in all of this, and I have Travis May up here, and we'll get to you in a moment, I promise. One of the more interesting examples of kind of where could other sports go if there is some kind of weird shakedown of programs that are forced to, if there's a theory that if programs are all forced to pay student athletes as employees, and I think they really are employees, but I mean, if to formally do so, you might see some teams forced into a club level, which would be somewhat similar to how they are in a lot of European countries, especially at university level. But there was one interesting kind of example of a club sports guy who's actually trying out for the NFL. I don't know how much likelihood of him making it is, but I wanted to mention him, and his name is, oh my gosh, I'm going to totally mangle it. He's a really interesting character. His name is Praise Olatoke. He went to Ohio State, I believe, on a track scholarship, but he ended up joining, because there is actually an intercollegiate club football where it's run by students, and they're full pads, full contact. The Ohio State team is actually pretty good. There's also teams at some universities that don't really have football, some that do. But he's a kid who came from Scotland. I think he's Nigerian, but he came from Scotland. So he's at Ohio State. He ends up going onto this club team. And then through the NFL's international access, or however they call it, he's actually getting to practice to try out for the NFL. So that one, I just want to throw that one out there, because it's one that I keep forgetting to mention. And I always like these kinds of unique stories out there in college football. And that's certainly one of them. But anyway, Travis, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me up here.
Yeah.
Being where I am now, I just kind of always live in the weeds, kind of constantly basically earn a law degree covering college football year round. And so it's just interesting, just as I've dug deeper into the history of specifically college football, you learn a lot about the foundations of where, how things got to where it is today. Like, I don't know about, many international sports and just the timing of the development of college leagues or college ranks in sports versus pro, but college football is rather unique versus a lot of other American sports in terms of, like, the timing of the development of the college variation of it versus the pro. Because, like, if you go through like with baseball, like the St. Louis Cardinals were playing in 1892. Like they were well established, you know, well before the college monster that is the modern NCAA was born. And like with the first professional, even like basketball leagues, which is, you know, the other big sport here in the US, just to your original point, ski mask. I mean, it was, they had pro leagues around 1900, even a shade before that, I believe. But the timing of the college football in general, like it was already a well-founded sport before the NFL ever began. And it took till 1920, of course, to have any professional version of football. And even when they finally did a draft in the mid-1930s, the player first who went first overall decided not to even play ever in the NFL because there was not enough money in it. So it's just the onset of like this weird dominant version of this nationally popular college sport with college football, you know, had a 30-year runway ahead of really 40-year runway of before any professional league gained prominence. And even so, it took another few decades for the money to really show up on the pro side, and then 100 years for the money to really make sense for college players to get compensated beyond scholarship as well because of the absurd amount of revenue. So it's just all this crazy amount of well-established norms has kind of set this, you know, created this perfect boiling point, you know, 100 years later. So it's just interesting looking back at the history and the establishment and the overlap of the timing of the two professional, you know, professional football and college football, and how that has impacted kind of every base level of the idea of compensation. And the NFL, you know, it's really your ski mask earlier. You're talking about, you know, the idea of like the NFL just kind of having no incentive to try to, hey, let's figure out how to pay all these guys ourselves because we have a free developmental league. That's basically how it transitioned. First, there was no way that the NFL could even pay players fairly. And then once they did, they realized that college football was this well-established, well-oiled machine that we could make our own policies to make sure that everyone has to stay at least 3 years in college. And that helps us out immensely. Free development for all of our future stars. And so it's really just the NFL's policy by themselves that make it the way to where, you know, players can't jump ahead uniquely.
Yeah, thank you for that. Ski Mask, I see your hand up, and then we'll go to Level Up Luke.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, Travis, like when you go through like the history of college football and like, well, really just American football in general, it is a very weird course. And then also like figuring out how, you know, the NFL and the NCAA got like this extreme amount of power over these great athletes and dictating their paths when originally the NCAA, even though it's over all sports, it was just founded on one principle to do one thing, which is, hey, could you edit the rules of football at the collegiate level and that the pre-NFL, but still like professional clubs were going against one another in certain places, like sort of college all-star teams, edit the rules so that we have less guys dying on the field. Because back then, basically, if you went to college for 4 years and you went to every single one of your team's football games, you would at least saw two people die on the field. So that was like their only start. And then like to see how things spun off is sort of, yeah, it's a very unique path versus other professional leagues.
Hey, Level Up Luke, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for having me again. Just to kind of echo what Travis was saying and kind of going, I think that was off of what Ski Mask was saying earlier. The developmental path of the two sports is very interesting in the sense that in England and Scotland, like Travis was alluding to, it was the professional game that started first. You had these local clubs starting to play soccer, and they became the dominant professional league based out of their communities. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the local community sides were at the universities. They were the school sports. So, you know, we famously have Rutgers, you know, inventing college football in the U.S. And you have basically England and Scotland creating it in overseas. So the developmental path, one starting off as professional and the other starting off as a collegiate amateur sport, very interesting. And then our NFL didn't really take off until much later, much, much later. the Premier League had been well established. Well, the first year of English football, at least, Premier League wasn't until 1990. And they actually took a lot of pages out of the NFL's book. So it's been some give and take between the two sides of the Atlantic. And now you have, I think, arguably the two most profitable sports leagues in the world, in the NFL and the Premier League. One of them having their own professional feeder system and the other having an amateur feeder system, going to what Ski Mask was saying. So, I mean, it's really fascinating. I feel like it would be a really good, like, John Boys, like, infographic YouTube video that you could sit back for an hour and watch, like, the path that these things take visually. But I actually did want to mention, like, the main reason the English League has a professional developmental pyramid is that it's profitable. And we're seeing that college athletics is extremely profitable. What is stopping professional teams from signing exclusive deals with specific college feeder programs? Like, what's stopping the Atlanta Falcons from signing Alabama as their feeder program? And I know we have a draft process, but it seems like if you do that and you can share in the revenue from the college athletics program, that may almost be more worthwhile. Because once you get past Division 1A, you know, to Division, I guess, FCS, you know, 1AA and below, it really is an amateur club program, essentially. The top level, FBS, is the only one that is a minor league feeder system.
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, the draft aside, there is some benefit to being open to all of these programs. Because, I mean, you can't necessarily, even with a team as loaded as Alabama, or I guess, you know, Georgia's taken that spot at this point, you know, you're still going to have spots where, you know, you won't get necessarily a Caleb Williams. You know, there's a chance of, you know, the opportunity to shop around. And, I mean, it is interesting, though. This has been, I mean, this conversation has been very interesting. Because it's funny to think about how, you know, I think the idea of the athletes becoming employees is going to be at the college level is going to be very, it makes it all so much, the pro leagues feel a lot better about the arrangement, I think, in some ways. Because first of all, they're not paying them. But second of all, I mean, as we just said with the G League in basketball, like the NBA may revisit that one team that is made of high school or former high school athletes that didn't go to college, just because now the college system has become attractive enough to maintain those teams. You know, I want to give, let's see here. Hey, it's Mage Ingrid. How are you doing?
Oh, hey, sir. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing good. I have a question. What he say is one reason that supposedly, I hear a lot that college football is more popular down here in the South than in the North, which is funny because it's down in the Northern State in New Jersey.
Oh, you know, well, there's lots of, gosh, I'd love to hear some folks and their thoughts on this. But, you know, some of it's evolved with time. You know, I remember reading an interesting, oh, gosh, it was ages ago, but how, especially on the West Coast and cities like Los Angeles, basketball has kind of grown to kind of supplant football. Some theories, for example, on the West Coast, and I know the West Coast better than the North, but, and the West Coast is kind of its own thing, but, you know, with the NFL obviously left LA for many years when the Rams and the Raiders both had initially left. And so LA didn't have a pro team. So there was thoughts that, well, who are the players looking up to? It was a big problem, I think, with you know, college football prospects. Some of these teams that used to be just absolute breadwinners for recruiting in the LA area don't really produce the talent they used to. And part of it is, you know, people were pointing out, like, some of the big guys, guys who might be great for football and being linemen and things like that, we're seeing Shaq and wanting to be Shaq. So they were all pursuing the basketball careers when Shaq was certainly unique in some ways, just as a physical specimen. But I've heard that theory as well. But, you know, Ski Mask, I see your hand up. I'll let you go at this.
Yeah, I looked into it once because, I mean, I'm from Virginia, so I'm sort of like in that little middle line area between, like, getting some northern aspects and some very southern aspects. But I only looked into it once, deep dive into like a small research paper in college. And the only thing that sort of came up multiple times was that so like the difference between the networks of cities and that what we consider the North isn't, you know, everything North, like basically everything north of Kentucky that's east of the Mississippi. And like just the connection between those cities and the fact that Ohio is like the central area, and that's where the pro club started out at, and they spread from there, and they just didn't go south. And then when you look at the south, it's really, you got Atlanta was a major hub, and not really too much else until you get to Nashville or go all the way to Dallas. So it's sort of like people were too far away to fall in love with the pro teams. You just fell in love with your local college team. Sort of similar to like as Level Up said, sort of with pro soccer in Europe. You know, they didn't have college teams, so everybody just fell in love with their local club team. And it's sort of a similar fashion. Even though certain areas are sort of different, like I went to University of Michigan. Everybody loves the Wolverines more than Detroit Lions, so Detroit Lions are so bad for so long. So you have some aspects, but there's no true way to go about it. But yeah, in the South, it is very different. I went to many Michigan games and no one ever got stabbed. But I've been to a few Georgia Tech games and I've seen blood.
Georgia Tech, no less, too. I mean, there's gonna be some folks in the South like, yeah, but it's Georgia Tech.
What the heck's with Georgia Tech then? Good grief.
Oh, my goodness. I'm loving it. You know, I wanted to mention just a couple of other quick stories. Just we can continue the discussion on whatever, including what we've just discussed. But I'm remiss if I don't mention that whole saga with Caden Proctor, who from Iowa, was committed to Iowa, then transferred, flipped to Alabama, started for Alabama last year, announces he's transferring, I guess, as soon as Saban retired, he's transferring to Iowa, where I guess they'd always kind of kept a good relationship with them. They never kind of burned any bridges. So he's apparently entering the transfer portal and he's going to head back to Alabama. So not sure what happened. I kind of like, that's now one of the stories I want to hear more about. Like, why did Caden Proctor, did he get to Iowa and then just suddenly realize, you know what, this just doesn't quite feel the same way. Did Kalen DeBoer kind of sweet talk him? I also want to know how Ryan Grubb did for those like 2 weeks he was Alabama's OC before leaving for the Seahawks. I mean, granted, maybe he just wanted to make that step to the NFL, or maybe really liked Seattle and wanted to return. But yeah, Caden Proctor is going back to Alabama. I can't wait to find out where that went. You know, and there was, of course, a whole series of moves in the administrative level, which we don't normally talk about. But my goodness, one of the stories we didn't get a chance to talk about was the shift of Trev Alberts from Nebraska to Texas A&M and how upset some folks at Nebraska got over that. Because to be fair, Trev Alberts is a Nebraska guy. I find the whole thing funny because when I got, you know, when I was in grad school, I really would just stay up late and put college football on weekdays where it was still available. It wasn't every night like it is now. And listen to some of the late night talk shows, you know, to kind of unwind from classes and stuff in law school. But I still remember the original college football final lineup where it was Reese Davis and what's his name? Mark May. And the thing was, Mark May kind of, you know, over the time, most people just think of Mark May as like towards the end of his ESPN stretch where he was like the villain. But he originally wasn't the villain. He was like set up as the good guy. And Trev Alberts was like the guy who kept putting the hottest, most outrageous, kind of almost borderline like, dude, you're crazy takes. And then he got fired very famously because he said, I'm not showing up to work until you give me a raise, is exactly how he put it to ESPN. And then next thing you know, they hired Lou Holtz to replace him. And then they didn't want Lou Holtz to play the bad guy, so Mark May played the bad guy. And then that's the show that most people know. And then Trev Alberts kind of, you know, he was kind of moving around. He was at College Sports CSTV, which is kind of a lower end college, college sports station. And then, yeah, no, he ended up going into administration. He did a good job with Nebraska Omaha, although they had to drop, I believe, a couple of sports, including football. I can't remember if he was there when they dropped their Division II football team. And then he took his alma mater's job, and now he's at Texas A&M. So that was kind of a whirlwind. But then, of course, you know, that always touches off some moves. So one of the other odd kind of stories in there is, like, again, Troy Dannon, who had been barely at Washington because Washington had previously lost their AD to USC. But apparently Troy Dannon is now going to be his Nebraska AD. Washington fans are kind of happy about that, which isn't always the coolest thing. He left the job in 6 months. While he was there, of course, they lost DeBoer to Alabama. I don't know what they could have done to prevent that from happening. If your coach really wants to coach at Alabama, what are you going to do there? Although he had fired the basketball coach and has left in the middle of that. But apparently, like, he wasn't really doing well over there, at least with meshing with some of the fans. His family hadn't moved. Apparently his wife refused to move to Seattle. So it sounded like that whole story wasn't going great to begin with. So this was just sort of a way for them to all save face. Another interesting move, again, I know administrator moves aren't interesting always, but I found it interesting that Fresno State this week has parted with their athletic director, Terry Toomey. That one's awkward because he was apparently a good AD and people liked him there. But for those who may have been keeping, and I'm sure a lot of you keep up with Fresno State sports, but they kept trying to pass a city law, I forgot what they call it, but they were trying to pass a way to get more funding for the university's athletic departments. Measures is what they call them in that area. So they tried to pass this thing called Measure E twice, and it failed twice, most recently in their last election cycle. So that inability to get money for the program ended up leading to this. I'm sure he was at that point, he was just frustrated. He tried twice. They made a couple of big pushes to get, you know, more money for the Fresno State team and build up what's there in that athletic department. And it is supported by Fresno. That's what made it kind of surprising. Fresno really does like Fresno State. Like, they show up to games. It's its own environment. It's a unique place in the Central Valley, which is where I grew up. They couldn't make it to work, at least on the legislative level, which I'm not entirely shocked by. And so that led to that departure. Let's see here. One other kind of oddball story I wanted to mention here. Preston Pearson, who's one of the director of recruiting and player personnel at Stanford, he put out a tweet that got some attention where he's like, I just got an email from a prospect who flat out asked me if he could post a fake offer from Stanford just to get, quote, his recruiting going. What's worse? Him asking, or that he knows, and he doesn't name the guy, Coach Clown is watching and offers based off of a tweet. College football is something else now. So that was, I mean, okay, Skimass Murphy, I see your hand up.
No, it's funny you mentioned that, because I forget the guy's name. He just came across my YouTube while scrolling, even though I sort of knew it, but this guy did an investigation. What that kid's doing is, it's not like the guy, who was the guy like years ago who did like the fake, was it fake one to Colorado or Hawaii or something?
Oh, it was Cal. That kid, yeah, he was like in some small town in Nevada, and he had a whole big press conference.
He faked a signing day. But hey, you got to give him props for that. Faking a whole signing day is nuts. But no, this guy did an investigation and basically like 24/7 sports of rivals and other things. It's if they found out basically as an athlete, if you get an offer, you automatically get 2 stars for your recruiting name. So the kid probably faked an offer. He just wanted it to build just to give himself a better star, which would actually help him out in recruiting, it's one of those weird things where it's like, yeah, you can game the system when it comes to college football high school recruiting for college. Long as if you get an offer, they'll just give you stars, even though no one's actually looked at how good you are.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, at the risk of derailing the entire episode in the soccer talk, there were some online trolls that created a fake, basically recruiting profile for a soccer player, and just put in a bunch of stats that they said he got in a South American league, and he started getting offers from European clubs. So
that I know the story you're talking about. That wasn't trolls. That was the player himself doing it.
Oh my god! Yeah. The troll is coming from inside the program.
This is in the early 2000s. So he created a recruiting page, and it went, and like he saw clubs actually using it. So he's like, I'll just throw myself in there.
Yeah. So we're not unique. You know, it happens all over.
Yeah.
Love to see it.
Oh my goodness, that's too funny. Yeah, you gotta love when they get creative like that. You know, it's so funny because like it's quieted down, and I'm not sure why, but I'm not complaining. We occasionally, even through the at Reddit CFB Twitter account, we'll get DMs from like random prospects, like high school players. Like, here's my video. And we're kind of like, how are we on your mailing list? What are we going to do with this? Like, or, you know, and actually over the years, it's shifted. It used to be the players. Now we're getting it from like a parent or like a handler. And I'm more embarrassed. I'm like, come on, man. You're like trying to help your kid. Why am I getting your kid's video? Like, I get it though. Like, what does it hurt to just send it to a bunch of random people? But I'm like, man, tell me you don't know what we tweet. You went like, what, we're going to go like, oh, wow, look at this kid. Like, he can run. I mean, I don't know. Like, it's funny to see how some of the stuff gets, how some of this happens, you know, behind the scenes. Oh my goodness. You know, let's see, one other kind of interesting kind of story. Let's see, that kind of came out. Oregon State, this is actually in the last day or so, but Oregon State and Washington State have reached a settlement with the other 10 teams that are departing, kind of basically gives them a chunk of money. However, the money, when you hear the number, it's like $65 million, something in that zone. It isn't as nice as it sounds. I mean, it's more or less, it codifies what was expected. In fact, I think John Canzano or John Wilner, one of those two guys who's so into the Pac-12 drama, reported this months ago, but it finalizes it. And so it gives Oregon State and Washington State basically a two-year cushion where they're going to be financially okay, but then after 2 years, presumably during those 2 years, they're going to be trying to get into the ACC, if it still exists, or the Big 12. If they can't in those 2 years, that means we'll probably then see what will eventually happen between them and the Mountain West, which is, you know, what people think. If there is no better offer, that would be the direction they would look towards. But that's one of those things that's kind of popped up in the news. Not sure what else there really is to say about it other than that kind of that we're getting some finalization in that. Mage Ingrid, I see your hand up.
Oh, I don't know if any of y'all saw, but I saw that Michigan and Ohio State, they're going to nationally televise a spring game. I saw, I forgot, one's going to be on Fox. I forgot the other channel. Did y'all see that? Because I saw that online before, like a few days ago.
Well, I mean, I can say Fox is the official media owner of the Big Ten, so that would make sense.
Yeah, it would be. Exactly. They're partners. I mean, it's occasionally happened. I mean, we'll see how much attention it gets. I mean, I do like that people are trying creative things. Like, I was just reading, I think The Athletic had the article today about how, and I mean, it's not like a scoop, but talking about how the Big 12 is having like a conference-wide pro day this year. I mean, Texas and Oklahoma, who are already leaving, kind of didn't participate. They did their own individual team days, but I thought pro days, but I thought it was an interesting idea. So, I mean, we'll see more of that. I know the NFL Network is going to broadcast the Big 12's pro day, which will have obviously a bunch more players than were at the NFL pro day. I still think this would be a great opportunity to shift to an American Gladiators type of situation and really entertain the masses, but we'll give that a couple of years before your mark decides to really kick it up a notch. Like, bring in Gladiators. Bring them back. I'm pretty sure Nitro and Gemini are probably too old to do this anymore, but you know, maybe we can find some former NFL prospects or some former WWE superstars to kind of go in there and, in you know, leotards, unitards, and kind of like clobber each other with pugil sticks. Oh my gosh, I saw a couple of hands go up. Ski Master Murphy, I saw your hand up first.
Bobek, you got to watch the 30 for 30. They can't bring it back. Now that everybody knows those people were not getting paid at all, it's not coming back. No one's going to be on there. They scammed those guys worse than the UFC scams their fighters. No one's going to sign up for it.
Pay the Gladiators, ooh, baby. If they can do that, you know what? If we can play college football players, I think we can pay Gladiators. We'll find the money. It'll be somewhere. Level up, Luke.
Hey, Ski Mask, what we need to do is let the Gladiators unionize, and that'll solve all the problems.
That's the NLRB story we want to see.
No, I was actually going to throw out a few things here. You got me thinking. So, unless I'm mistaken, I believe Fox actually owns the Big Ten media rights. ESPN and their conferences are partners, but I believe Fox actually bought the marketing rights for the Big Ten. But I was also going to say, it came out recently, I heard an interview with part of this Clemson ACC lawsuit ESPN has a ACC media opt-out for their contract deal in 2025, which is like halfway through the term that went till 2036, I believe. So ACC was locked in for the full term, but ESPN had an opt-out halfway through, and now they could potentially exercise that while this Clemson and FSU case is going through the court, or cases, plural. So if things get too hairy for the ACC, ESPN has poison pill, I guess they could swallow to sour that whole deal and seal the death roll for the ACC and send all those teams scattering. And that just came out as part of the Clemson lawsuit in South Carolina court.
Yeah, that Clemson lawsuit is something else. Like, I'm not going to claim that I'm an expert in that jurisdiction. But the gist of it is, like, they're saying, yeah, we signed this grant of rights. But grant of rights just shouldn't work. They shouldn't apply. Like, it's such a weird argument. They're basically saying, like, yeah, we have these contracts, but contracts just shouldn't be allowed to be enforceable, which, oh, man, good luck with that one. That's a little too
I don't know. As a South Carolina resident, let me tell you, that makes it sound like you're a West Coast liberal elite who's not familiar with our judicial system.
You get kicked out of this. You get kicked out of this then. So, like, I teach tort law, right? And one of my favorite cases I teach, it's actually out of South Carolina it's ages ago. It's like in the 50s. But the whole thing is, like, whether or not people would be professional malpractice if they're following things that everyone else is following. And it's this case where, I'm not going to bore with the details. Basically, it's an insurance fraud case. But somebody realized that no one was actually reading the laws as they were written and serving people with their, like, summons correctly. So these out-of-state law firms, like, who were representing insurance companies that were going to be defrauded, looked at the paperwork and they said, like, you know, you've got to dismiss the plaintiff because they never served it the way they were supposed to. So, like, the judge is reading over the paperwork and everyone must be, like, actually reading the laws of South Carolina this day. And they realize, oh my gosh, you're right. No one's ever done this the correct way in this history of the state. So they dismiss the case, and afterwards, unsurprisingly, the plaintiffs sue their attorneys for not filing it correctly. And the Supreme Court of South Carolina basically said, and this is actually a teachable, like, this would be agreed upon, although it would never happen again. Well, when everybody is following a rule that is incorrect, it's actually not entirely incorrect because that was the custom. So you can't say they were being malpracticed because that was apparently allowed and no one had ever challenged it before.
But that makes sense, right? Like, if you think about it, that kind of makes sense. Like, common law or squatter's rights. If you've owned a property outright for a certain amount of time, then legally it can be presumed that you have a right to the property. So
there's definitely adverse possession. That is a
fun one. I'm a realtor.
We could get really into the weeds in some of these things. So, but hey, Ski Mask, I see your hand up.
I mean, if we're talking about the way the law is handled by lawyers in the state of South Carolina, isn't that the place where the one guy, like, basically hired a hitman to kill his whole family, then someone hired a hitman to kill him?
Absolutely, the Murtaughs. Yeah, the Murtaugh murders. Wild. Well, and so this is crazy because I went through a extremely minor civil case with a neighbor. I learned in that process because I wrote up, you know, full report, you know, 10, 11 pages and cited existing law and case structure. Like, I did the whole nine yards, and my neighbor just showed up and talked to the judge, and it went against me because the judge said, well, I went in the back room and Googled, and it seems like, you know, it would just be fair to do this instead of the existing law. I learned through that process that the judges in the state do not have to have any legal background whatsoever. they literally can just go in the back. They can go in the back room and Google something, and that's fair play here. So.
Oh, that's a headache. Oh, my goodness. You know, we've certainly gone a little bit off the rails, and I think that's a good hint that maybe it's a good time to slowly wrap this up. One last story. And this guy, there's a guy on RCFB, and it's kind of a little less of a traditional thing, but he's been running these competitions of that wildest name in sports. And I mean, all sports. So he did this one and people were critical of him because he was using nicknames. Nicknames aren't fair. So he did one with birth names. And it seems like we're getting a runaway favorite in all of sports, like not just college sports, not just pro sports, not even just American sports. And It seems to be a French professional basketball player from Cayenne. So French Guiana, which if you know French, the French approach, they consider that part of France. They don't consider it like a colony. It's part of France. But Steve, ho you fat. Three words, ho you fat, exactly how they're spelled.
Fantastic.
Seems to be the runaway winner in all of this. And I'm looking at his jersey. It's awesome. It literally is. Oh, you fat. Look at me. This is, oh my goodness. So Steve, you know, congrats. It looks like you're absolutely going to be the runaway winner. And he's 6'8". My goodness. So again, I hope he's, so his paternal grandfather was an immigrant from China. So he looks African, but I mean, yeah, that he's got that, that it's his grandfather's where the ho you fat comes from. So my goodness, that's an interesting one. Well, that was, if he plays college football at some point, well, he's 35, so I doubt it. We'll let you know. I think that's a good place to wrap this up. If you missed the beginning, this turns automatically into recording. We'll get this to wherever you get your podcast. It's RCFB Talk. This will be RCFB Talk 186. I'm Bob Akhayeri. We do these every Tuesday night where we almost mostly talk about college football and whatever it is you'd like to talk about. It's always a pleasure. It's great to hear from all of you. Thanks to everyone who joined me up here. I hope you all have a great rest of your week. Now, I'm going to hang up and listen.